basically we should move back to our supersymmetric world. So remember that we started with a renormalizable quantum field theory. I needed to start with renormalizable quantum field theory because I wanted a path integral to be well-defined so that I can actually, if needed to, I can make very formal the arguments that I was making as far as it concerns pretty much what we did in order to get effective action. So as effective is a Legendre transform with respect to a source of a connected, of a generating functional for the connected diagrams. So a Legendre transform with respect to a source of a generating functional for the connected correlation functions. So it was IW of that ln that as a function of the source, and then what we did a Legendre transform for this guy, and then we got an effective action. So as effective as a function of some auxiliary field phi hat was equal to W of J minus integral d4x J of x phi hat of x, where this phi hat of x is just del W over del J of x. Okay, so these operations can be made very formal and well-defined as long as we talk about renormalizable quantum field theories. And then what we talked about is that there is a very nice expansion. Again, in all realistic cases, we cannot compute it precisely, and so we have to rely on some approximation. And so the useful approximation in a context of effective field theories is derivative approximation, which instructs us to actually expand this effective action into the number of derivatives our field phi has. And of course, whatever expansion we will do, it must be Lorentz invariant. And so I'm just going to write down two first terms in the expansion. The first one is a term that does not involve any derivatives, and then there is a term which involves two derivatives, and then it can be multiplied by an arbitrary function, okay, without derivatives, and it goes on, okay, higher derivatives as well. So the thing is that what we ended up is emphasizing the fact is that we do not quantize effective action, because already the way how I presented it, it contains all the quantum information, and in fact the whole purpose of this effective action to recast the quantum theory in terms of, if you wish, auxiliary classical field theory. And so this auxiliary classical field theory has a classical field phi hat, and then it has an effective action as effective. So it doesn't, strictly speaking, make sense to ask, is your effective field theory renormalizable or not? Because the questions about renormalizability or not are the questions about quantum correction, and it doesn't make sense to ask those questions here. So on the other hand, this effective field theory, I told you, is equivalent to the full quantum field theory, and so it must encode in some way information about the full quantum field theory, and that's how it does. So remember, in quantum field theory, observables are time-ordered well, not necessarily time-ordered. Time-ordered are the easiest one to study, time-ordered correlation functions. And so we can go from the correlation functions, we can go to amputated correlation functions. I'm not going to remind that. So the bottom, if I look at this effective potential as a function of phi hat, so it can be proven rigorously. And I think the good reference for this is a book by Zin Justin. Okay, this is Zin Justin book. So if you need to know some specific, more specific references, that, then we can look it up together with you. So the idea is, well, I can expand this. I can expand this in infinite power series in terms of this field phi. So with conventional minus sign in front. So I will have 1 over n factorial. And then there will be a coefficient here, which are multiplied phi vx to the nth power. So it turns out that these coefficients, those are the numbers, and those are, so there are n zeros here. And so these guys, gamma n, are the amputated correlation functions of our QFT at zero momenta. Okay, so correlation functions, amputated correlation functions at finite momenta will come up from these dotted things. But so the expansion, if I just look at the effective potential and you expand it, if somebody would give you, okay, this is a precise expression for the effective potential, then you can read off directly what are the amputated correlation functions at zero momenta in the full quantum field series. So this would have been a full result if you happen to know the effective potential to all orders. So I don't have time, and this is not the purpose of the course to derive this, but you can see, you can start getting a feeling that this effective action is actually very complicated. So in particular, because on a quantum field theory, I can ask the question, what is a correlation function involving 2007 fields? That's a valid question, and that will give me some answer. And so this guy will be a certain particular term, which tells me that effective potential will contain a term phi raised to the 2007 power. It's not a problem from the perspective of renormalizability, because as I emphasized again today, is that we do not renormalize effective field theory. It's already taking care of all quantum effects. So, right. So, first we start with the correlation function. For example, phi of x, phi of zero. Right. Oh well, they just all depend on x minus y, you can say. So this is right. So I can look at this correlation function. So this is a 2-point correlation function. So this is, I denote it as G2, right? G2 of x. So, okay, so this, in this one, there is not much to amputate, but in principle, if I have, I think, let's look at the 4-point correlation function, right? So this is x1, x2, x3, and x4. So G4 of x1, x2, x3, and x4 would be a time-ordered product of phi of xn, okay? And now the amputated one, gamma 4, So what you do, you take this four-point correlation function, and you divide by a two-point correlation function. So you divide basically by the propagators, right? So so it's G4 of x1, x to the fourth, divided by the product of propagators of xi minus xj, right? So all the propagators that you have. So usually what I have there, that's a amputated correlation function defined in a momentum space. So what you have to do, and it's actually much easier for me to explain that in a momentum space. So what you do a Fourier transform. So you first go from a coordinate space correlation function to a momentum space. So then it will be k1, kn. So I forgot my normalization. I think I use this one. Well, with xi to the n product. And then I have e to the minus, I think, plus ki xi of gn of x1, x to the n. And so there is a delta function here of k1 plus k to the n, because there will be a momentum conservation, or all of its correlation functions are translationally invariant. So this would be, this is not amputated correlation function. And the amputated one, when I take the Fourier transform of that correlation function, so gamma n of x1 kn. So in the case of the free field theory, it's going to be very simple. So I just divide by a propagator. So a propagator, 1 over p squared, pi squared plus m squared, right? So this is delta I. And so I'll just take the non-amputated correlation function, kn, and then I just divide it by a propagator, product of propagators at ki. Okay? Great. So let's see. I don't remember. So, well, how I normalize my, you know, my Fourier transform, whether I use square root of 2 pi, but to the nth power. So it's, and I don't have my notes here. Yeah, wherever, yeah, there is some standard, there is some standard normalization, right? Okay, good. So let me go back. Let's see. And go back here, right? So I told you that those are amputated correlation functions at zero momentum. And in fact, it's, as you can see, it's a very formidable exercise to compute it precisely. But we can compute it order by order, order by order in perturbation theory. So in particular, we can start looking at this quantum field theory when we have a potential of this type, plus lambda over 4 factorial pi to the fourth, and we can ask the question. So this is our classical potential. So what is going to be our effective potential? And the computation of this type, so just to give you an idea, what will happen is that, well, you will have a mass term. And then you ask what type of interactions will arise in your effective field theory. And pretty much what you end up doing is computing these amputated correlation functions. But diagrammatically, what will happen is that you started with a quartic vertex, right? So there are four fields phi, and there is minus I lambda here. But then at one loop, so this is classical. So effective potential to leading order will just have these type of interactions, nothing else. But then there will be loop corrections. And so, so if we look at one loop correction, right, so we have a loop, what we want to do, we want to attach external legs to this loop in such a way that we use the fundamental vertices, the ones that we started with, the vertices that connect four fields. So there will be, first of all, there will be a renormalization at one loop level of this coupling, right? So this is still, I have four external fields. So the effect of this one loop diagram will be to renormalize me what I call lambda, okay? Make lambda energy dependent. But then at one loop level, there will be other diagrams. So there will be other contributions. So what I, which are not present before, okay? And they just come because there are non-zero higher order correlation functions in our quantum field theory. For example, I can have a diagram of this type. This is still a one loop diagram. Each vertex connects four fields. It's a one loop, so I can evaluate this diagram. And so this diagram will produce me a term in my effective field theory, which will behave like phi to the six. And so you can go ahead and you can see that, you know, you can play these games and attach as many legs as you want. And so what you will end up doing, you will end up generating a Taylor series expansion of this type, where this correlation function is computed to one loop order. And there are some standard procedures in quantum field theory how you do that. Yes.
Potential
equal
zero loop order isn't really the potential potential. You already have
six-point
diagram, right?
No, I don't. That's all I have. So if I look at this, then I just have a max jump, and I have a quartic interaction. That's nothing I even have.
But if you look at the four-point diagram, if you could just make another interaction point and add three legs to it, then you have a diagram with a total of six. No, just first two, no. Like,
you mean this one?
Yeah. Or is this potential one?
Yeah, it's irreducible, right? So it's one part of the reducible diagram, right? So I didn't go into it. So those gamma, I skipped a lot. Step at one foot zero. So these ones are not one particle reducible. So if you are interested, there is a very beautiful paper which you will end up seeing anyway to the late in your career. And this is Kalman Modulo, and this is Kalman Weiberg potential. And I don't remember the reference, but it's a very famous paper. The first paper, as far as I understand, where the computation of this type has been done. So this is Kalman Weiberg. But the reference to the original paper, you can look in the book by Cheng and Li. So there is a discussion there, and there is also a discussion in the Justin book as well. So just to give you an idea what will happen, it turns out that you can implement this procedure. Well, this is a perturbative computation, so you can do it order by order. And so the right way to organize computation of the effective potential by loop orders, not by the couplings, as you can see. So the answer for this theory will turn out to be a famous Kalman-Weinberg potential. So this is 1/2 mu squared. Strictly speaking, I have to use phi hat squared, but at this order, there is no wave function renormalization, so there is no difference between up to this order, there is no difference between phi hat and phi. So plus lambda over 4 factorial phi to the fourth. So those are the terms that you've seen before, and then there are a one loop corrections. right, which is a summation of all these infinite set of diagrams. And those turns out to be encoded in this nice formula, m to the 4th squared 64 pi squared. And then here I have ln m effective squared as a function of phi over mu squared, and then there are some corrections. Yep. So what is this m effective squared of phi equals mu squared plus lambda over 2 phi hat squared. So notice that in the effective potential, there is an arbitrary scale. There is an arbitrary scale mu. Scale mu that shows up. And so this is a scale, well, okay, so in principle, there will be an arbitrary scale here. That arbitrary scale is chosen. Did I choose it to be, well, so conventionally people choose this scale to be the same as a mass scale, but in principle they can be different. And so this is a scale, remember I was telling you that if you don't have classical corrections, then a coupling constant is energy independent. And once you start including quantum corrections, for example, a diagram of this type, then there will be an energy dependent correction. So your coupling will start run with energy scale. And then the question will be at which energy scale you evaluate the coupling. And so then the question would be, when I write down the lambda, I mean the lambda evaluated at the scale that I put here. So again, this computation is not very difficult, and some of you might have seen in your quantum field theory class, but this is a very good quantum field theory exercise to do it for yourself when you have time and try to derive it. All right, guys. So as I said, in order to derive a result like this, what you end up doing, you end up computing diagrams of that type. And those diagrams will diverge. So what you need to do, you actually, well, in quantum field theory, it's easier to do computations in Euclidean space. So what we do, we will do Euclidean rotation. So the integral, the loop integral, for example, well, if we look here, so there will be a Euclidean momentum running in the loop. And so the diagram will diverge, okay? So if I say that the integral over virtual particles in the loop is restricted up to lambda, right, then this diagram will end up being quadratically divergent. So if you, strictly speaking, you have to integrate over all the Euclidean momenta, right? And so you will get a result which diverges quadratically as you remove cutoff. So here, lambda is a cutoff. And what we are talking now is actually making sense of infinite diagrams. So this is a regularization. So the other diagram, for example, the one that will contribute to the renormalization of the quartic coupling, again, there is a Euclidean momentum here. And if we restrict the integration up to lambda, then this diagram is logarithmically divergent. So this diagram will diverge logarithmically. So again, these divergences will happen if we will use our original Lagrangian. However, as we discussed before, the whole purpose of introducing counter terms in renormalizable field theories, so that once you include counter terms, then the counter terms will remove these divergences. Okay, so. So you can think of this that then there will be additional diagrams. So there will be a counter term of the type that will remove a quadratic divergences. So this is additional diagram from counter-term. So this counter-term will be the one that would be responsible for the mass renormalization. And then there will be a counter-term that I would have to introduce in order to renormalize this diagram. So this would be a counter-term for the Fort decoupling. So so the bottom line is that when we do renormalizable quantum field theories, all the quantum correction would simply amount to redefinition of bare couplings in our Lagrangian, and there will still be a finite number of parameters that we need to fix in order to define quantum field theory. So the procedures that I just explained to you, so we look at the diagrams that contribute to different correlation functions, and we regularize them by introducing the cutoff. So this procedure can be implemented in any theory. So now we move to non-renormalizable field theory, and we will ask the question, what the difference would be. So regularization can be implemented in any quantum field theory. It doesn't matter whether the quantum field theory is renormalizable or non-renormalizable, because the whole point of renormalization is artificial restriction of the virtual momenta integration. And so in principle, if I were to start with a non-renormalizable quantum field theory, for example, I will start with a field theory which has m squared over 2 phi squared plus lambda phi to the fourth over 4 factorial plus, phi to the sixth, right? Phi to the sixth term must come with some scale, lambda squared. Let me make this mu squared. So I can still write down my Feynman diagrams, and I can compute one loop corrections, and I can evaluate effective potential, right, by again isolating the diagrams that contribute to correlation functions, and then building up, much like we did in the case of renormalizable quantum field theory effective action. So what we will find out is that in this case, we will get an infinite sum of the type. So this is regularized, right? So I haven't done anything. I use the series that I started with, and the only thing I did is that whenever I see a quantum loop, I do not integrate over all the momenta, but I integrate over loop momenta, which are restricted by some scale lambda. So I will have what I have classically, plus then I will have an infinite set of corrections. So those are corrections that will start when n is larger than 4. Well, let me write it down, n larger than 2. And then I have phi to the power 2n. And then I have right, so over e, it's more difficult for me to do this. So let me do this, and then n even. I just don't want to waste time figuring out the right power. Phi to the n, and then the scale, in order to make the effective potential the right dimensions, will be lambda to the power n minus 4. And then there will be some coefficients, cn. So those coefficients will depend on mass, will depend on my bare coupling, and will depend on this scale mu. Okay? So I can do this, and I can do this no matter what field theory I'm talking about, renormalizable or non-renormalizable. The huge difference between renormalizable and non-renormalizable quantum field theory is that I have done nothing. I started with my bare Lagrangian, and I evaluated one loop corrections, and as we discussed before, restricting the momenta. And the difference is that in renormalizable, quantum field theory, we have finite number of counter terms. So finite number of extra contributions to a Lagrangian such that the total effective potential, which will be the effective potential that we will compute using the bare Lagrangian, if you wish, plus there will be a contribution to the effective potential coming from counter terms. So if my theory is renormalizable, then it is possible to find counter terms in such a way that this sum is lambda independent, or maybe more precisely, find it in such a way. I think it's best to say what I was saying is lambda independent. And so what we can do, we can actually take a limit. We can take a limit of lambda goes to infinity, and then we will get V effective physical. Okay? So So this artificial parameter lambda that we introduced in order to make sense of the diverging integral will simply not be present in the final physical result. And so we will get a physical renormalized effective potential. So in the case of non-renormalizable, so it is not possible. It's not possible to set up a finite counter terms. Again, the important thing is to have a finite number of these counter terms so that ultimately we will need a finite number of experiments to fix all undetermined constants. So it's not possible in non-renormalizable QFT, is not possible to remove lambda dependence. Okay. Moreover, not only that, it's actually much worse than this. What happens is that the effective potential in non-renormalizable quantum field theories, QFT, will depend crucially exactly how you restrict momenta running in the loop. So in non-renormalizable quantum field theory, V effective will crucially depend on a particular way, on a particular way in which you regularize divergent loop integrals. Okay? So in other words, not only you will get an infinite number of unknown parameters that you need to fix from experiment, moreover, there is an infinite ambiguity how you do it. In the renormalizable quantum field theory, it doesn't matter how you regularize the theory, because you can show that you will get, after all the infinities are subtracted, the renormalized theory that you will get is equivalent no matter what regularization procedure you use. So here, you can get completely different looking effective potential. So the answer for that is easy to understand physically what will happen. So what is the meaning? How should we think about quantum field theories, effective quantum field theories? So suppose I have a scattering of two particles, and in the center of mass, I have a Mandelstam variable S. So I have P1 and P2, and so S is P1 plus P2 squared. And so I'm just colliding these two particles. So so I want to know what will happen as a result of this collision. So the theory might involve complicated non-renormalizable interaction. And but as long as, for example, S is much less than lambda, then the only part in the effective potential that would matter, as far as the scalar field theory concerns, if effective potential of phi, provided that momenta is much less than lambda squared, so the only part that will matter is just a mass term and the quartic coupling, lambda phi to the fourth over four factorial. All other terms in this effective field theory, remember that if I have phi to the n here, sum, when n was larger than four, I have to divide by lambda minus four. So this will introduce additional interactions, but those additional interactions will be suppressed, because in the collision, I simply don't have enough energy to probe those interactions, okay? So when we write down effective field theory, we can still use it as long as we understand the regime of validity. So if we have a cutoff in this effective field theory, then our effective field theory is valid when the processes that we look at, we study with this effective field theory, has the scales which are much lower than the cutoff scale in this effective quantum field theory. Now, what I was saying here, it is possible to remove lambda dependence in renormalizable and not possible in non-renormalizable. What this means that if I have a renormalizable quantum field theory, my theory is standalone. So the theory is well defined to study any scattering at arbitrary high energy. On the other hand, here, especially which I was telling you, the process at which you regularize the theory is crucial. What that would amount to is that if you go to high enough energy, so in non-renormalizable theories, so when S becomes of order lambda, lambda squared, then usually what happens is that you will start excited, you will start exciting additional particles, okay? So extra states are created. So probably in two lectures or so, we will discuss the idea of integrating out massive states, and then it will be more clear, and it will be more clear the way how you arise, how you obtain effective field theory, starting from a field theory involving some massive states. So for now, it might not be very clear. So you will create a particle. You might create a particle here, which will have m squared of order lambda squared, if you just have enough energy in the scattering. And if your theory is non-renormalizable, the thing is that your answer for the effective potential will depend on the way how you regularize it. Physically, that corresponds to the statement is that the theory will be sensitive. What is the spectrum of massive particles you have? Which is a very obvious statement. In other words, non-renormalizable theories are not theories which exist as quantum field theory on their own. They require a UV completion. So this is a message that I want to say is non-renormalizable quantum field theory require a UV completion. So we need to specify. So what this means is we need to specify the massive spectrum of non-renormalizable theory for states of order or larger than the cutoff scale. And clearly, so my effective field theory just doesn't have this information at all. So it doesn't know what are the massive states above this cutoff scale. And so if I choose a different spectrum here, I will get a different theory. And so you might guess that if you would have an absolutely correct theory with the whole spectrum to infinity, wherever you use the effective potential will actually depend what massive states you have. That's why that is actually the origin that not only you will need to tune an infinite number of parameters there, but as long as you look at the non-renormalizable theory, there is this very bad arbitrariness. And the arbitrariness stems from the fact that you just don't know what the massive spectrum is, and you change the massive spectrum, and you will get a completely different result for the effective potential.
So is this clear?
All right, guys.
I guess it's very hard to make predictions because you have regularization MPUs.
Well, what I'm saying is that suppose we start. So the example that I have, and I said a lot of this last time, so I will be brief here. The same thing happens with gravity. So as long as, so you look only at the gravity, right? So the gravity is non-renormalized. So there will be an infinite set of operators. But what I'm saying is that there is an intrinsic ambiguity. If you try to play games, how you make sense, put it on a lattice, discretize space-time, or introduce a cutoff in the loop diagrams, as we discussed, there are different ways to do it. And you might say, oh, my way is better than the other. So my way is better than yours. First of all, we will get absolutely different physical answers. So the thing is that you have to realize that we will start differ with you when we study processes, scattering processes at the scale of the cutoff. But our answers will be vastly different. What I'm trying to say is that there is absolutely no way to figure out who is right, you or me, if we use different regularization procedure. Because different regularization procedure secretly imply that we are using different spectrum of states above the cutoff. But since neither of us knows what the correct spectrum of states above the cutoff, there is no way, just from the perspective of the effective field theory, to figure out whether your effective field theory is right or wrong. See, that's a huge difference from the renormalizable quantum field theory, because renormalizable quantum field theory does not require this extra state. It contains everything to be a well-defined quantum field theory on its own.
That's why there is no this ambiguity of this type in the renormalizable quantum field theory. Okay? So in the context of gravity, right, so this is something that I was mentioning before, is that if we start computing the effective action in gravity, including loop corrections, so what we will find out, so this is in gravity, so what we will find out is that the Einstein-Hilbert term will receive corrections, r squared over m Planck squared, there will be some number plus r cubed, some number over m Planck to the fourth, and so on. There will be an infinite set of corrections. And again, so you can parameterize, so you can choose some numbers, and it's okay as long as, so as long as you study processes, if their momentum in your scattering of so you study scattering of gravitons, then if s is much less than m Planck squared, then everything is okay. And well, but it is okay in the sense that you can forget about all these terms and you can use just Einstein-Hilbert term. The thing is that whenever and for this reason, there are lots of tons of wrong papers that people write. For example, they look at some effect. They look at some effect, which is very sensitive between those two terms. Okay, so they say, I'm going to look at this effect and, for example, make a statement that there is a UV fixed point in gravity. Okay, there is a way of figuring out some coefficients in such a way that you will get some renormalization group fixed point in gravity. But the point is that what they never discuss is that they're doing a very specific regularization. In other words, they are assuming that there is first of all, it's very difficult to go the other way around. Somebody gives you an effective field theory, say with a specific set of coefficients. What is the spectrum of states that would extend to infinity so that once I integrate out those states, I will get your effective field theory? This is a very difficult problem to solve. And so moreover, they might use not all, you know, if you give me a spectrum of states and you say I'm going to make those states to interact, it's not clear that the quantum field theory that you will write down will be a consistent quantum field theory. So what I want to say is that you cannot, when you do the computation, you cannot rely on effects. When this additional, if you do effective field theory and you find out that in order for you to make a physical prediction, you need to rely on the first five terms in your effective field theory, it's very likely that your result is invalid. Because if this term has exactly the same effect as this one, then you are at energy scales of your cutoff, and then not only those terms that you look at are important, but also an infinite set of terms are important, and moreover, they all come with unknown coefficient, and there are infinite set of unknown parameters. So that's why it's very difficult to actually make a prediction with effective field theory at energy scales much larger than the cutoff scale or at the cutoff scale. But effective field theories are useful if you want to ask the question, so I do a very high precision experiment at low energies and I want to know, do I have an operator? Do I have a non-renormalizable operator or not? So that operator will have a very small correction. So you are in this regime, and in this regime there is a hierarchy of these terms. And so it is a physical question to ask, what is the value of this coefficient? How big it is? Do I have it or not? So that's the type of questions that we can ask in the experiment. The only thing is we cannot extend those arguments to make some new physical predictions that rely on some leading corrections in effective field theory. All right, guys? Yes.
so the regularization scheme, does it start to not matter if you're just low enough below the ladder cutoff, or? Because doesn't this mean that doesn't the light that if you can make a measurement, then it depends on your regularization scheme?
Well, the regularization scheme, simply speaking, the regularization scheme cannot produce you something that you cannot write down before based on dimensional analysis, right? For example, in lambda 5 to the, 5 to the n Quantum field theory, I wrote you an infinite set of terms. But then I used dimensional arguments. I said that the cutoff scale I have will be lambda, and so you just have to make the right dimensions. If you go ahead and do the computation, you will find out that indeed the effective potential of that combination that will end at 5 to the m over lambda n minus 4. The coefficients that you will get, of course, will be different. They will depend in a way how you renormalize. But what I was saying is that from the experimental point of view, it's not worthless, because you're not, what you care from the experimental point of view, do I have that term or not? Is the coefficient a non-zero or not? We believe, at least, you know, at least this is my belief, that the quantum field series that we talk about are actually well-defined, to arbitrary high energy. If the theory is defined to arbitrary high energy, in some sense, a normalizable theory. Though the issues of renormalizability can be obscured, then there is a well-defined procedure to get this effective potential with all the numbers fixed. Right? So, for example, in the case of gravity, that's the thing that I mentioned, is that if I say that I'm looking at the gravity that comes from the low energy dynamics of string theory, then I don't have a choice. All these numbers that I'm saying will be a very specific number I can compute.
But doesn't kind of the reverse problem of the landscape of string theory tell you that at least in string theory you have kind of at least a either quantum infinite or very large number of possible unique computations of?
No. It has nothing to do with, you know.
You have lots of complexification.
No, it's what you're saying is has nothing. I think this is a misconception how some people present it. Suppose I have, let me look at the theory, and let me give you a very simple example. Okay. And then we can talk about, this is, okay, I hope that that will address this issue about landscape of string theory, and I'm looking out to go into more details.
So suppose we have a potential, okay, so I'm going to make a potential with a negative mass squared, phi squared, and then a positive contribution with a quartic coupling, right? So mu squared is positive, and I choose lambda positive. How does my potential look like? Well, you know, for small values of phi, it must go like this, right? But eventually what will happen is that it will go up there. Now, if I give you this potential, and I ask you, is this theory renormalizable or not? You answer me yes, because we do power counting, so I have two operators. This is an operator O2. This is an operator O4. The coupling of the operator G2 has a mass dimension plus 2. The coupling of the operator O4, which is G4, has a mass dimension 0. So they all have positive mass dimension. So according to a standard analysis, that's a renormalizable theory. If it is a renormalizable theory, then it will have a unique effective potential. I told you that if it's renormalizable, a path integral is well defined, so I can compute an effective potential exactly. Okay? And then the question is, okay, but notice what you are telling me, look, but my theory has two vacuums. And I say, okay, so what? I'm going to choose this vacuum, but I have an exact answer for the potential, because my theory is renormalizable. It's unambiguous. And so I can choose, it is true, there is a choice that I have to make in which vacuum I sit. But once I choose in which vacuum I sit, my effective field theory has a unique prediction. There is an infinite set of terms, but they are uniquely fixed. So exactly the same situation is happening in string theory. Except that in string theory, because it's a much more complicated model, what you have, you don't have just two vacuums or finite set of vacuum. You have infinitely many of them. But that's a choice of vacuum. That has nothing to do about, you know, the issues. If I'm going to write down an effective field theory, whether my effective field theory is well-defined in this vacuum or not. So
what this means that if you're going to do some other approach, so you start with effective field, which is, my understanding is that the way what is done in, for example, quantum gravity is in some incarnations of it, is that what you are doing, you are just doing an effective field theory. And so you have an absolute non-predictability of what my interactions is in a given vacuum. There is still exactly the same problem there that is being faced in a string theory. How do I choose a particular vacuum? I can ask you in this model, what will choose me this vacuum instead of this vacuum? There are just two vacua. They are identical. I build up a model which has a Z2 symmetry. So which vacuum is chosen, I don't know. So sometimes the question, what is the vacuum selection mechanism, I don't know that those questions make even sense. But what does make sense is that once this selection process occurred, I can ask what are the interactions. So at this stage, the choice of vacua, I claim that all approaches to quantizing the gravity are the same. So the opponents of the string theory mostly say, oh, you know, there is this, you know, nothing can be done, blah, blah, blah. But exactly the same words are applicable to any approach. Because in any approach, you are facing with the question of a choice of vacuum. And sometimes, as I point out on this simple example, that question I don't think has a physical relevance. Now, the next question is, what are the interactions in that vacuum? So that's where the string theory gives a specific answer, and the other approaches do not, because they don't know the complete.
I was just about to say you don't know, well, you have a string theory vacuum are distinct and you don't know in which vacuum you are from your energy effective
theory. Well,
like from the terms which you can measure in any reasonable way. So you don't know.
This is incorrect. Because if you give me an effective field theory like here, okay, the effective field, or for example, in a Coleman-Weinberg model, I mean, this is a Coleman-Weinberg model, so I can write down the effective field theory. I will choose this Coleman-Weinberg model with negative n squared. There will be a unique answer. Actually, using the effective potential over the whole space of vacuum, I can ask the question, what are the possible vacua in my model? That's exactly how people figure out that in string theories there are infinite set of vacua. Because they looked at the effective potential that come in the string theory, and they asked the question, what solutions do we have? So from this perspective, I would call that, okay, as far as I would ask the question, is my thing background independent in which sense? In some sense, the effective potential is a background independent quantity, a background independent characteristic of the theory which allow you to scan all possible vacua. And it's exactly the same thing which happens in string theory. In a string theory, the analog of this effective action is a supergravity. And so we can ask the question, so there is a supergravity, what are the possible vacua in this supergravity? The problem is that much like in Coleman-Weinberg did not compute effective potential to 207 loop order. It's difficult. Now in string theory, it's even more difficult, so we have to do some approximations. But the concept is not very different. There is a well-defined notion of the effective potential, which is computed in certain approximation scheme. And of course, if you break that approximation scheme, then you will be punished. You know, you should not trust your answer. So the statement in string theory is that
we can build up this vector of the landscape using a well-known physics, using a well-known features in string theory, and so we will trust them. But I'm saying that in principle, that's not the issue, because then the whole, once you choose the vacuum, then there is a unique prediction in a given vacuum. All right, guys? Very good. So,
I don't know how to pick what vacuum.
Wait, I told you, how do you pick a vacuum in that model?
Well, that's not the, you could do, well, in that model.
Yeah, how do you pick?
There's no difference between the vacuum. If you put some small term to destroy the symmetry, then you could do it.
But yeah, I don't.
Yeah, but the issue is that if all the string theory vacuums are the same, yeah, it wouldn't matter.
Okay, fine. Let's suppose
I make this one deeper.
Yeah, so then you could do an experiment to tell what vacuum you're in.
And we are doing experiment in string theory. We have our world. Our world is an experiment which tells us in which vacuum we sit.
Right.
But you still have to go through this infinitely many to find which one corresponds to it, which is kind of the problem.
Do I? I mean, if I tell you, suppose I have a complicated scalar potential. Okay, this would make a theory nominally normalizable. Suppose I would have a potential like this. Okay, and then I know that the vacuum energy, or the minimum of the potential, is set in particular value. Do I have to browse all infinitely many of them, or I can just say, okay, I know that all this infinite set would have a vacuum energy that is larger than this value. Suppose I can prove, which is very often what happens. You don't have to do that. For example, you know, it's sort of similar type of argument is that if I have 300 positive numbers, I don't need to add them all to discover that the sum will be positive. I know first that, okay, I'm adding every number is positive, so the answer will be positive. I don't have to do this. So it's all this. What I don't like in the whole idea of landscape is the idea of statistics. I don't think there is much physics there, because there is not much physics as to which of these vectors is statistically preferred. I'm facing a problem there, because I cannot translate that problem into the language of the effective field theory as I told you. I don't know what that means, what the statistics would mean there. But actually, in quantum, in condensed matter, we have exactly the same landscape. So when we have a system, and then we put an impurity, that impurity will be localized around a particular atomic site. So you have a landscape, right? That impurity could have ended up anywhere. But for whatever reason, it ended up in a particular spot. Does condensed matter bothered by that they have an infinite set of, you know, a landscape of vacuum for an impurity? No, they don't care. They say, okay, we're going to study a particular spot where my impurity will end, and I'm going to study electronic properties, or, you know, the phonon, how my phonon will interact with impurity, once I know that the impurity is there. So the questions are I claim that the questions are exactly the same as they are in the context of landscape. There is an unresolved question, which to me, I'm not really sure whether it's a scientific question, what chooses the vacuum? Though many people disagree with me because they try to put a measure on this space, which I don't know. But after that, everything is well-defined. Once I say, okay, this is the vacuum, the string theory, if you can do the computation, the problem is that, honestly, we cannot in most cases.
And we can't do the experiments either.
No, we can do experiments. We have LHC, right?
Yeah, but... Okay.
So we can ask, for example, we can ask from the perspective, as I was pointing out, is that we can ask the question, suppose there are certain operators, mm-hmm. and we can ask, are those operators present or not? The problem is that, which I also alluded to before, is that there is no unique answer. So you might see an operator, but you don't know whether this operator comes from this sphere or from some other sphere. Because again, the thing is that things are very degenerate. You might have a completely different spectrum of massive states, and they would correspond to the same looping effect that you see. So going backward is not one to one, it's one to infinity. All right, guys, so let's cut it here. And what we're going to do now, we're going to go back to our supersymmetric model, and that ends our discussion of renormalizability and quantum field theory effective. Actually, the idea of effective action is very important, and we will use them. We will use them to derive non-renormalization theorem in our quantum field of theory. Okay, so what we are doing now is we are considering power counting renormalizability of SUSY quantum field theory. So again, we just restrict our attention for now for quantum field theories, including only chiral superfields. So the supersymmetric Lagrangian in this case can be written, you remember, there were two functions. One is an arbitrary function, a Kala potential of chiral and anti-chiral superfields. And plus, there is a holomorphic function, a function that depended only on chiral superfields, okay, plus Hermitian conjugate. So this was Kala potential. This is a superpotential. So this guy depends on both chiral and anti-chiral, and superpotential can depend only on chiral superfield, and Hermitian conjugate will depend only on anti-chiral superfield. So if we recall our SUSY algebra, so let's just do some scaling arguments. Because ultimately, a supersymmetric superfield language is just a packet. It's just a useful way of repackaging quantum field theory data. So let's look at our SUSY algebra, Q alpha bar. So this equals to 2p alpha dot equals 2 sigma alpha dot p mu. So p mu, the mass dimension of p mu equals plus 1. We have a momentum, so it has mass units plus 1. So if I look at the algebra, that immediately tells me that the mass dimension of my supersymmetry generators is 1/2. So now Q alpha, if you remember, it contained I wish I have the, I can never remember this. So so it contained derivative with respect to theta, and Q alpha dot bar, it contained minus derivative with respect to alpha dot bar. So so if I told you that Q alpha has a mass dimension of 1/2, then because Q alpha, if I realize a corresponding supertranslation, then that tells me that the mass dimension of my theta parameters, so Q alpha is, let me write it down with, doesn't matter which index I write. So my theta parameters has dimension minus 1/2. And now remember that the derivative with respect to theta, the differential d theta is the same as taking derivative with respect to theta. And so so the mass dimension of d theta must be also plus 1/2. Okay? So the reason I did this exercise because we can figure out what must be mass dimension of our Kala potential and the superpotential. Again, so our action must have a mass dimension 0. So my Lagrangian must have a mass dimension 4. So d4 theta, the mass dimension of that is 4 times 1/2 equals to 2. And so in order to make sense that this integral give rise to a dimension 4 object, I would have to conclude that the mass dimension of my Kala potential equals plus 2. So d2 theta has a mass dimension 2 times 1/2 equals to 1. So a mass dimension of a superpotential equals plus 3. So remember that the simplest Wasmino model, the simplest one that we look had a Kala potential of this type. And so in that model, because a Kala potential, well, whether I have a field or I have a complex conjugate of that field, it will have exactly the same dimension. So the mass dimension of my chiral superfield is plus 1. Okay? So which is a classical dimension for the scalar field, which is not a surprise, right? So if I look at my chiral superfield, I have an expansion of a chiral superfield as a scalar, plus there is a root 2 theta psi of y plus theta squared, and there is an auxiliary field of y, where y is x plus I theta sigma sigma bar. So if I have a mass dimension of my chiral superfield equal plus 1, so each term here must have the same mass dimension plus 1. So I can see that the scalar component of a chiral superfield has plus 1. So this is scalar. So now this theta has a mass dimension minus 1/2, right? So this is minus 1/2. So this guy must have a mass dimension 3/2. This is minus 1. So this must have a mass dimension 2. So the mass dimension of psi equals plus 3/2, which is a canonical mass dimension of a free fermion. Okay, and then the field F, which is auxiliary and not dynamical, happen to have a mass dimension plus 2. So having understood that, we can go back and ask, okay, so our Wasmino model, if you remember, was identified. Wasmino model was identified. So in principle, when we look at the superpotential, there can be infinite number of terms. But in the case of the Wasmino model, what happened is that this infinite series would truncate at the cubic order. So there are dots. So this would be a Wasmino model. And the whole stuff here would be what we call nonlinear sigma model. Okay? So in a context, let's look at the Wasmino model. Okay? So we know that the mass dimension of a superpotential is 3. So we know that the mass dimension of any chiral superfield is 1. So I'm assuming that I have a simple Kala potential. So if this guy is 3, this guy is 1, this guy is 2, this guy is 3. So I can read off the mass dimensions of coupling in the by Zumino superpotential in the superpotential of the mass Zumino model. So the mass dimension of mu ij equals 1. The mass dimension of lambda ijk equals to 0. Now, the interactions that will come up from the superpotential, so the interaction potential will be proportional to the derivative of the superpotential square. And so in the Zumino model, all the couplings, let me write it down. So in Zumino model, all couplings Gn has a positive mass dimension, okay? Because again, in a superpotential, they have positive dimension. And once we go from a superpotential to a potential, basically what we are doing, we are just squaring it. And so what this implies is that the Zumino model picks up most general supersymmetric SUSY renormalizable quantum field theory QFT for chiral superfields. Okay, so that's a special status of the Zumino model. Any questions?
Yes. Should she take the derivative of the of W for
with respect to
particles? By expansion one. So
it doesn't matter. The thing is that I will never get this couplings in the denominator. So I will never generate couplings, which so those are the only couplings they have. So they come polynomially here. So the new couplings that will be produced will be squares or multiples of that. There will be not a single one in the denominator that I would interpret as a new coupling of negative mass dimension. Right. So now I'm talking about very important things,
which we already mentioned before, but it's important because we have to deal with a nonlinear sigma model in some way. So notice that this analysis that I did here, they are done using Keller potential, right? Using Keller potential to determine the mass dimension of my chiral superfield, right? So this is known as a kinetic scaling. Kinetic scaling, meaning that I use kinetic terms. Keller potential encodes kinetic terms of my theory. So I use kinetic terms in order to determine the correct scaling of my field. So as I said, that raises a question. How do we deal with nonlinear sigma model? And the problem there is that both the Keller potential there and W of phi I, so those two functions are arbitrary. Okay. So, and in particular, even if I have even if I have in this nonlinear sigma model, if I have a simple Keller potential, phi over phi bar, right? So then in this kinetic scaling, this would imply, again, that the mass dimension of my chiral superfield is plus one, but then this is an arbitrary function. So what this tells me that I will have a nonlinear sigma model contains non-renormalizable interactions. And so the statement is that we must think about nonlinear sigma model as an effective field theory. So the field theory, which is valid about some cutoff, so nonlinear sigma model must be an effective quantum field theory. At least I must interpret it as an effective quantum field theory, valid below some cutoff. Cutoff scale lambda. So given all these problems that we discussed before in a context of effective field theories, that there is very little we can do. So you might worry, okay, these effective field theories are completely useless. But I told you that this effective field theory is valid when I ask about processes with characteristic energy is much less than lambda. What I'm saying now is that I can trivially satisfy it, can be trivially satisfied if I choose E equal to zero. Of course, zero is much less than any other positive number. And zero is a valid question in a supersymmetric quantum field series because it's a question about supersymmetric vacuum. So what we just discovered with you is that an effective field series, supersymmetric, SUSY effective field theories are useful and always valid because of the reason that zero is always much less than any positive number, are useful and valid to study vacuum properties. Of the theory. So they're useful to ask the question, do I have a supersymmetric vacuum, states with zero energy, or do I not? So in fact, the whole thing of landscape and string theory is actually a question of the effective field theory of precisely this type. Because the effective field theory that we talk about there is a supersymmetric field theory. And all the spontaneous symmetry breaking that happen in string theory, all the supersymmetry breaking that happen in string theory are spontaneous. So if we think about this as an effective field theory, again, let's flash back to the beginning of today's lecture. Remember that I was writing you down an effective field theory, effective, the choice of phi plus del phi squared z of phi, right? So as long as we are asking the question, what is the vacuum? So where do we have vacuum in this theory? Then we think about the vacuum as a configurations with constant in a context of quantum field theory, in a context of string theory, for example, slowly varying constant or slowly varying fields, slowly varying. Eventually, actually, even in quantum field theory, I want to make fields very slowly vary because I want to study interactions in the given vacuum. And if my field is slowly varying, the energy to do this slow varying field is actually the energy density required to do that is very low. So I'm still in this nice regime. Actually, the first one is much less than lambda. So with constant or slowly varying fields. So because these are the type of questions that are best answered in the effective field theory, the kinetic term and actually all the derivative terms are not important. Derivative terms are not important. So what this tells us that if we ask the question about nonlinear sigma model and how we define the scaling, Keller potential in nonlinear sigma model with respect to scaling must be somehow irrelevant. As far as questions concerned, which can sensibly be answered with this effective field theory. So exactly how to set up the scaling in this nonlinear sigma model, but you might already have guessed that whatever we will do will depend just on the superpotential. Okay? So there is a way of asking the questions and setting up scaling dimensions just from the superpotential, and exactly how it's been done, we're going to talk with you next week.